Well, good morning, everybody. Driving up to church this morning, many memories from past visits flashed through my mind. It's been about 25 years that this church has been supporting us as we have moved from place to place in ministry as God has called us. Thinking back to around 1984, when this church began to support us, we were on our way to Uganda. Later on, we moved to the country of Ukraine, then on to Russia. And more recently, we've been for the past 2 years living in the city of Pasadena, working at the U.S. Center for World Mission. I want to say before I go any further, thank you very much for hanging with us for 25 years. You are important to us in many ways. We have friends here that we look forward to coming back and seeing and catching up and see how things are going with you. So it's a special time to come back and see you again. One of the themes, I guess you would say, in ministry for us for the past 25 years has been theological education. I started a small theological institution, a Bible college, when we lived in Uganda. I was a teacher at a Bible college in Ukraine, teacher at a Bible college in Russia. And, you know, you kind of hope, I suppose some of us might hope, that sometime in the future you might have your perfect job. Well, I can look to the past. I've already had my perfect job when I was teaching at the Bible college in Uganda and being the director of the school as well. So looking to the past, I've had my perfect job. Then I was a teacher for a number of years, teaching only, really. And in Pasadena, I have switched hats again. There's a university connected with the U.S. Center for World Mission, and I'm the vice president for academic affairs at that university. So now I'm entirely administrative. So I was frustrated for about 10 years. When I was teaching only, so I figure I have another 8 years or so to go of being frustrated with administration only. If you talk to teachers, of course, they look down on administrators. We are about the lowest form of life on the planet. I hope that you'll bear with me this morning, recognizing that I am that very low form of life. But God created us all. He has a plan and purpose for each one of us. One of the things that I do want to point out to you was mentioned earlier. There is this magazine. There are a few of them there in the lobby. It does say quite a bit about what the U.S. Center is doing. It lays out the ministries that the U.S. Center is involved in. So if you'd like to know more about the sorts of things that Carol and I are involved in Pasadena, this would be a good place to start. So again, thank you for hanging with us for a quarter century. And in 25 years, I will be almost 80. So I hope you hang with us for another 25. Well, let me turn now to the story in Luke chapter 7. And let's try to understand what God has for us this morning. It seems to me that on Mother's Day especially, it is appropriate that I say something about women. This is a special day for you ladies, and so I have prepared a message with you in mind. Now, I do want to say that it is permissible and acceptable, allowable for men to listen. You don't have to leave the sanctuary. You don't have to put in earplugs. You may stay. However, I'm not talking to males this morning. I'm talking only to women. I mean that literally. You guys can listen in. Maybe you'll find something interesting that will apply to you as well. But I mean this quite literally. I'm speaking to the women this morning. However, I do feel an obligation to acknowledge a birth defect that I have. As you can see, I'm male. Which means that I really do not see life from a woman's perspective. I just can't. You know, I get secondhand input from various sources, including my own wife. You know, she tries to help me understand how it looks from a woman's point of view. But I don't want to pretend to you this morning that I can actually see it from your point of view because of the birth defect that I have. So I'm going to try to do the best I can with this very severe limitation that I hope you'll bear with. Well, when we lived in Russia, when we lived in Ukraine, when we lived in Uganda, it was obvious that the women in those societies had very difficult lives. Very, very difficult lives. I think it's fair to say that the women in those societies had much harder lives than did the men. For example, both in Russia and Ukraine, the alcoholism among men, alcoholism rate among men is around 80%, which means that in almost all families, the men are worthless. So, if the husband and father of a family is an alcoholic, who takes care of the kids? Well, obviously the wife and mother is the one who takes care of the kids. Well, if the husband of a family takes care, if the husband of a family is an alcoholic, who takes care of the wife? No one. There's no one to take care of the wife if the husband is an alcoholic. When things go wrong in a family, most of the time the greatest burden falls on the women. This is how it really is. And you know, if we're honest with ourselves about life in the United States also, that's pretty much how it is here too. So when I say that in general, in Uganda, Ukraine, and Russia, it's the women who have it the hardest, I think you have to include the United States in that list of countries, that list of societies as well. Now that's changed some in the past 30 years. Women do have more opportunities now in the job place, in the marketplace, than was the case, say, a half century ago. Nevertheless, it remains true that when things go wrong in the home, the burden for handling things, for making things right, for struggling through, the greatest share of that burden falls on the woman. So, let me say to the women this morning who have hung in there when your man has gone a little bit flaky, when the kids seem to be in trouble, and your husband is not doing very much to help you out, well done for hanging in there. Well done. God is pleased with you. He really is. Congratulations. You've done well. Praise the Lord. Now, I do, in all fairness, I do have to concede that there are a few godly men around. But as I said just a moment ago, I really am not speaking to the men this morning. I really am speaking to the women. So again, praise the Lord that so many of you have done the right thing when times have been tough, and especially when the men in your lives have not pulled their share of the load. So it's no coincidence that on Mother's Day, I'm talking about a story from Luke chapter 7. We have read that story just a moment ago. And here's the one point that I would like for you to take away from the message this morning. Suffering women activate the sympathetic power of God. Let me say that again. Suffering women activate the sympathetic power of God. Now, you might have a misconception or two about this story in Luke chapter 7 today. Obviously, it was the son in the story who died. And so you might think that the needy person in the story was the son. After all, it was the son whom Jesus raised to life. And that would be a mistake if you're thinking that it was the son who was the needy person in the story. On the contrary, if you look closely at the text, Jesus felt sorry not for the son who had died, but for the living woman who had some difficult problems to face. Jesus felt sorry. He felt compassion for the living woman. Now, you might think, oh, well, it was the mother's grief that Jesus was reaching out to, trying to touch and make and to heal by raising the son from life. And I'm sure Jesus was aware of her grief. But what Jesus did went way beyond just patting her on the back and saying, I'm sorry, I know how you feel, and hang in there, and God will be with you. No, he did a lot more than that, didn't he, in the story. So I think Jesus was aware of the woman's emotional pain, and certainly he cares about that too. He cared about that in the story, but what he was really aiming after, I think, was much more than that. Let's think for a moment about the plight of this woman, this mother, whose son had died. Verse 12, it says that she was a widow, and although in general, in Jewish society in those days, it was difficult to be a woman. Women in Jewish society in those days were much lower than second-class citizens. So it was hard to be a woman in Jewish society in those days. It was even harder to be a widow. And I think this is an important point to notice in our story. Very simply, in the time of Jesus, there was no righteous way for a widow to earn a living. In this story, this woman had no male relatives. She had no other means of support. She had no honest way to earn a living. It was her son who was her sole means of support, and the son was dead. There was no factory for her to work in. There was no office for her to find a job. She couldn't go to Target or 7-Eleven and work a cash register. She couldn't do any kind of menial labor. There was nothing that she could do. Well, there were two things. Neither one of them particularly attractive. Either she could become a beggar, which was probably her most realistic choice, or she could become a prostitute. Those in real life at that point in time, those were her real choices. Now, since she was being supported by her son, I assume that the mother in this story was older as opposed to younger. It doesn't tell us how old she is, but I'll just guess and say that she was probably closer to 40 than she was to 30, for example. All right? Well, if that assumption is correct, let me say it this way. I doubt that she would have been able to have an extraordinarily lucrative business as a prostitute. People being who people are. All right, so if that's the way she's going to go, that's not going to be very successful, just on a human level. So then that leaves her with the choice of being a beggar. Well, I have difficulty conceiving in my mind what a highly successful beggar in Jewish society would have looked like. She had no good choices. She didn't have any real choices. What did she really have look forward to in her life? Well, she could look forward to poverty, extreme poverty. She could look forward to disease. She could look forward to getting sicker and sicker and sicker. She could look forward to complete destitution, genuinely being homeless. So she could look forward to extreme poverty, illness, and probably an early grave, preceded by a lot of physical and emotional and spiritual suffering. So when Jesus walked into town and he saw the funeral, and he realized that the only son of this woman had died, he knew all these things. And so, of course, his attention would focus on the woman, because she's the needy person in the story. So what that the guy was dead? So what? It was the woman who needed help. So it wasn't the fact of a dead body that moved Jesus to act. It was the real problems of a living woman. There's a verse in Isaiah chapter 1 that relates to this story. Jesus is embodying what this verse in Isaiah chapter 1 is intending to communicate. Generally, in Isaiah chapter 1, what you read is a list of sins that Judah has been committing, and then it switches over and says, okay, instead of sinning, these are some things that you should do. Verse 17, Isaiah chapter 1, learn to do well, seek judgment, relieve the oppressed, judge the fatherless, plead for the widow. If you're going to do the right thing, stand up for the widow when she's in trouble. That is exactly what Jesus did here in Luke chapter 7. It's exactly what he did. He saw what her problems were, and he did something very, very concrete to deal with those problems. So in Luke chapter 7, Jesus is not protecting the widow against some aggressive male, some powerful male who is abusing her. No, he's not doing that. Jesus is not comforting the widow because the man in her life has walked away and abandoned her. No, Jesus is not doing that. No, instead, Jesus in this story is protecting the woman against death itself, because it is really death that has attacked this woman. Yes, it was the son who died, but it's the living woman who had to live with the consequences of that death. All right? So Jesus pleads the cause of the widow by raising the son back to life. It's for the sake of the mother that Jesus raises the son back to life. It's against death itself that Jesus is fighting in this story. So here in this story, when Jesus raises the son to life, you get a glimpse of the future victory that Jesus is going to have over death, speaking now about resurrection that comes much later in the story. In this story, Jesus gives life back to this woman. Of course, she's still physically alive, but she's the one who's standing on the edge of the pit. She's the one who is about ready to fall into unbelievable misery. And so Jesus is fighting against that particular expression of death in her life. Now, some woman in the listening to me might say, I wish Jesus would do for me what he did for that woman in this story. I wish Jesus would perform a miracle for me. I can't say how sin is manifesting itself in your life, in the lives of your loved ones, those who are closest to you. It might be broken relationships in your family. Perhaps someone you love is caught in self-destructive actions. There might be illness. Maybe there are economic problems. I don't know how sin might be manifesting itself in your family life. But Jesus stands against all of that. Jesus stands against death in all the different ways that it manifests itself in our lives and in our society. Jesus is standing for life in this story. So I can't say exactly what he might do for you, but this is what Jesus is standing for. This is what he wants to give us, to give each woman who is listening to me. Jesus stands for life and against death in all its forms, in all its expressions. Or another woman might ask, why hasn't Jesus done for me what he did for that woman? Why hasn't he done that? I don't know. I wish I could answer that question, but I don't know. I can't say what God might do for you in a particular situation. I really can't say. But I can say what he is able to do for you in a particular situation. Jesus does not stand with males who oppress and abuse women. He stands against those people. He stands with you who suffer and must sometimes lead very difficult lives because of circumstances beyond your control that have been thrust upon you. Jesus does stand with the weak, with those who in their distress cry out to him and beg him for release, for help, for salvation. Jesus stands with those who cry out to him in their time of need. So in your time of distress, please, ladies, don't stop clinging to him. Cling to him ever more tightly. Don't stop asking him simply because times are tough. Don't stop asking him for help. Hold on to him. Who knows what he'll do? Who knows how long you'll have to wait? But he is standing with you. He's standing for life, in your life. You see, it's the suffering of women that activates God's sympathetic power. I'd like to turn next to something about the nature of God himself. I want you to see also something essential in this story about God himself. Verse 13 tells us that God had compassion on her. Jesus had compassion on the widow. Well, the Greek word that is in this text and the Hebrew word that stands behind it means something like this. When Jesus saw the widow and understood her situation, his heart squeezed or convulsed when he looked at her. That's what the word compassion or pity means in this verse. So if you've ever looked at someone or at some situation and your heart hurts just so bad, it's like you can't even take a breath and you're just like this, that's what Jesus felt. That was his reaction on the inside when he saw what was going on in her life. If you've ever looked at someone suffering and you have wished with all your heart, oh, I wish I could do something to make this right, to make this situation better, to fix what's wrong, just do something. That's what Jesus felt when he walked into town and he saw the terrible plight of this woman. If you've ever been overwhelmed with grief, not because necessarily of the death of someone, but you look at the people who are left behind and your body quivers, that's what Jesus felt when he saw the condition of this woman. Our God is not emotionally detached. He is not emotionally uninvolved. He is not cold. He is not dispassionate or uncaring. Mm-mm. Our God is deeply, deeply emotional. A deeply, deeply emotional person. If you go back to Exodus chapter 34, there's an interesting list of the attributes of God. Exodus chapter 34, verse 6. Well, I'll start with verse 5. And the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there with Moses and proclaimed the name of the Lord. And the Lord passed by before him and proclaimed, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and in truth. All right, so here where it says mercy, this is the Hebrew word that we might better translate as compassion or pity. So God appears to Moses. Moses, here's the first thing you need to know about me. I am a deeply, deeply emotional person. And when you quiver, when you hurt, I quiver and I hurt. When you're happy and you rejoice, I'm happy and I rejoice. I feel what you feel. I know what you're what you're going through, I'm the tuning fork that resonates emotionally with everything that goes on in your life. That's what Jesus does here in this story in Luke chapter 7. What moves God to act on our behalf, more often than not, I think, is this deep well of feeling that he has for us. He looks at us. He sees the mess we have made of our lives, the mess our society is in, sometimes the mess that our families are in, and he says, we got to do something. And out of that shaking desire to act, he does act. Well, here is a negative example of what I'm trying to say. Once when we lived in, when we were living in Russia, I was on a bus, and at the bus stop, this very old woman got onto the bus. She had a couple heavy loads, bags that she was carrying, and she kind of tottered onto the bus, and she was doing the very best she could. She obviously wasn't particularly healthy, and I was seated, and towards the front. So I saw her basically as she was just coming onto the bus, and I looked at her, and I thought to myself, oh no. I can just imagine, you know, the difficulties that you're having to deal with. You know, from the stories that people told us, you know, in the city that we were living in, the kind of lives that a woman like that must be living. I look at this woman and I think to myself, this is terrible. This is terrible. And I didn't realize what I was doing until a woman nearby got up and gave this old woman her seat. All right, so I just sat there. Okay, so I'm sitting there feeling her pain, but I didn't move. Another woman had the wit, the training, the manners to get up and give her a seat. All right? What I'm trying to say is God is not like that. He doesn't just sit there and say, oh, I'm so sorry you feel bad, and I'm not going to do anything. No, that's not what our God is like. God feels our pain and then does something about it. That's what this story in Luke chapter 7 is promising us from God. When God feels our pain, that pain does not immobilize him as it did me. No, I'm not like God. In the story, did you notice what Jesus did specifically with respect to the woman? He speaks to her. There's the funeral procession going on. He sees what's happening. And he speaks to the woman. Interesting that we never know the woman's name. Never says that her name is Mary or whatever. She could be anybody. He says to the widow, stop crying. He doesn't say, don't cry. In the Greek text, the idea really is, stop crying. Isn't that kind of an odd thing to say? I think if I had been that woman, I might have been maybe a little confused, maybe even angry. Stop crying, you say? I can't stop crying, she might have thought. Look at what has happened to me, and you say to me, stop crying? I have to cry. What else can I do but cry? Look at my life. Look what's happened. Stop crying? How can I stop crying? And then Jesus touches the coffin, the bier, whatever it was that the body was lying on. He touched the coffin, and according to the law of Moses, that would have made him unclean. So that didn't matter to Jesus, all right? Whatever discomfort or inconvenience it might have caused him was immaterial. No, he focuses on the woman and he goes up and says, no matter what, I've got to help you. The important thing was that Jesus had to reach out and do something to help that woman. All right, so this is God, this is our God in action. It's not a detached God who waves from heaven and says, yeah, I see you guys are suffering down there. Hope it's going well. No. No, that's not our God. He sees our suffering. And that suffering of women activates his sympathetic power. A number of years ago, I saw a movie where a man apparently died of drowning. And they found his body. They're having a wake, talking about the man as you're supposed to do at a wake. And the wife of the man who drowned, she had some medal. I don't remember exactly what it was, that she wanted to pin on his chest. And so when she pinned the medal on his chest, the man woke up and started coughing. So, of course, people were surprised, to understate it. They screamed, they cried, they ran out of the room. You know, what in the world had happened? Well, obviously he wasn't really dead, right? He was in a coma, but they thought he was dead. And so you had people screaming, running out of the room, some of them out of fear because of what had happened. And I think in the story, maybe some of them were sad that the man had actually come back to life. Well, in this story in Luke chapter 7, clearly it's the resurrection of the dead boy that is the central act in the story. It is telling us something about Jesus' power over death. Now, one of the difficulties that we have in interpreting stories in the Bible sometimes is that it's hard to tell exactly what a particular story is intended to teach. Fortunately, in this instance, there's something in the near context to tell us exactly why this story is here. Chapter 7, verses 22 and 23. Then Jesus answering said unto them, go your way and tell John what things ye have seen and heard. How that the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, to the poor the gospel is preached. And blessed is he whosoever shall not be offended in me. The dead are raised. Luke is arranging these stories here in Luke chapter 7 and earlier also to illustrate the fact that Jesus is Messiah. The new age has started, the hope of Israel has arrived, and Jesus is doing the very kinds of things that we would have been led to expect that Messiah would do when he came. This verse, verse 22, this is a paraphrase of some verses in Isaiah 29 and Isaiah 35. So Jesus is just saying, you want to know who I am? Here are some verses from the Old Testament that summarize what Messiah is supposed to do. I'm doing these things, so you know I'm the guy. So here we are in Luke chapter 7. Jesus is doing something, raising the dead, that you expect Messiah to do. Therefore, Jesus is saying, I'm the guy. I'm Messiah. I'm the one that you've been looking forward to. Notice the reaction in the crowd. In verse 16, they glorified God, saying that a great prophet is risen up among us, and that God hath visited his people. Well, the geography here is very interesting. A few miles away from this very spot where Jesus performed a miracle, two times in the Old Testament, once in 2 Kings 4 and another time in 1 Kings 17, different prophets raised sons back to life and returned them to their mothers. So everybody in the area would have known those stories from the Old Testament, from 1 and 2 Kings. And so another, much, much later, hundreds of years later, another prophet comes to town and does pretty much the same thing. So people did not run from the room screaming, oh, no. They ran from the funeral procession. Wow, it's happened again. God is here again. He's come and visited us. Look what he did. So people knew those stories. And what does Jesus do when he comes to town? Well, he comes to town and spoils a perfectly good funeral. That's the sort of thing that would make your toes tingle. You can imagine conversations about the story sometime later. Maybe a traveler is coming through, And somebody from the town would have saying, yeah, you know, we were having this funeral, oh, terrible situation. The only son of a widow died. Oh, very sad. And this ordinary-looking guy comes along up to the funeral procession, talks to the woman for a moment, touches the coffin, and the son sits up, and he comes back to life. Now, I am of a skeptical nature, all right? So if somebody had said that to me, I think my first reaction would have been, no way, that's impossible. And the only answer I think you can give from this story in reaction, in response, is way. That is exactly what happened. That is exactly what Jesus did. It's not impossible. This is who our God is. Well, sisters, I want you to know the kinds of things that God wants to do on your behalf. At the present time, it's true that God has yet to wipe away every tear. You continue to shed tears, and I'm sorry to say probably tomorrow you might shed some more. But, you know, there have been a lot of female tears shed since Jesus performed this miracle in Luke chapter 7. Nevertheless, he is standing with you, and he is standing for life in your life. So please, I ask you today to remember what Jesus did in that town. I ask you, please, to remember for whom he performed that miracle. Please remember that it is your suffering that causes his heart to squeeze and convulse. Cling to that hope, please. Hold on to that hope. Don't stop holding on to him, please. And by the way, happy Mother's Day.
Thank you so much, my brother. And now, a year ago, I talked to Dick and Charlotte. They love hymns, and I love hymns. And I congratulate the choir for the hymn today that they song. I really, this is one of the few churches, this the only one church here, and there's another church who's seen one hymn in the service. That's it. But we love hymns, because those hymns means those people wrote it because something happened in their life. And so they sing hymns across the country, and I invite them a year ago. So you're going to have a flavor now of what they're going to do tonight. Pastor will speak on Revelation 1:19, the key to the book, and I give you 7-8 pages for your collection, but they will lift up our heart and so on. So please, Charlotte and Dick, come in and now take you over and sing. And those in the radio, you can be sure that our program will be absolutely complete. I have to keep talking because the people in the audience need to know that we are on the air. And they have two guitars, and that's very Spanish. And we really love this. Go ahead.